Today is Tuesday, November 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition, and I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the second week of public hearings in U.S. President Donald Trump's impeachment inquiry gets underway with testimony from four officials.
If the president abuses power and invited foreign interference in our elections, it will be up to us to decide whether those acts are compatible with the office of the presidency.
Also ahead, Hong Kong's chief executive calls for calm, and military cost-sharing talks between Seoul and Washington break down. Those stories and more are all coming up next. The second week of public hearings and the impeachment inquiry of U.S. President Donald Trump got underway this morning. House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff kicked off the meeting by thanking Jennifer Williams, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence, and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the National Security Council's top Ukraine expert, for testifying.
Today's witnesses, like those who testified last week, are here because they were subpoenaed to appear, not because they are for or against impeachment. That question is for Congress, not the fact witnesses. If the president abuses power and invited foreign interference in our elections, if he sought to condition, coerce, extort, or bribe an ally into conducting investigations to aid his reelection campaign and did so by withholding official acts, a White House meeting, or hundreds of millions of dollars of needed military aid, it will be up to us to decide whether those acts are compatible with the office of the presidency.
Republican Ranking Member Devin Nunes took time during his opening statement to liken the proceedings to ones of the past.
If you watched the impeachment hearings last week, you may have noticed a disconnect between what you actually saw and the mainstream media accounts describing it. When you saw three diplomats who dislike President Trump's Ukraine policy discussing second-hand and third-hand conversations about their objections with the Trump policy. Meanwhile, they admitted they had not talked to the president about these matters, and they were unable to identify any crime or impeachable offense the president committed. But what you read in the press were accounts of shocking, damning, and explosive testimony that fully supports the Democrats' accusations. If these accounts have a familiar ring, it's because this is the same preposterous reporting the media offered for 3 years on the Russian hoax.
The morning session with Jennifer Williams and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman is the first of two hearings being held today. And joining us on the phone right now is VOA congressional reporter Catherine Gibson to break things down. Catherine, welcome to the program.
You're so welcome.
So what's unique about the hearings today is that both Williams and Vindman were both on the call with President Trump and President Zelensky on July 25th.
That's right, and that makes really a huge difference because in the first week of testimony last week, we didn't have those firsthand witnesses, and that was an opening, quite frankly, for House Republicans who said that all they were hearing was testimony that spoke to hearsay. Now they don't have that argument. So what we're seeing from House Republicans is a bit of a character attack on the witnesses that we're seeing this morning.
You mentioned that, and that was one of the things that Adam Schiff made note of in his opening statement, is that he hoped that they would not be attacking the individuals themselves. What are Democrats trying to paint this morning in their line of questionings, and what has been the Republican line of questioning as well?
So the Democrats are saying that now that we're hearing from firsthand witnesses on that July 25th phone call, we're getting direct accounts of what Democrats are saying is a case of bribery, that the president withheld aid in return for help with a personal political favor. Republicans, on the other hand, have really stayed away from Williams, one of the first witnesses this morning, and focused on Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and what they are saying is some of his conflicts of interest. You know, he was offered a defense post in Ukraine at one point, which he immediately reported to his superiors. They're using that as a way to try and portray him as a man of shifting loyalties, So far, he's coming across quite strongly that he believes in the United States, his adopted country, the country he came to as a toddler, and that he believes that the phone call the president made was completely wrong.
As we mentioned, this is the first of two different hearings scheduled for today. What's coming up later this afternoon? Who's testifying and why is it important?
Right. We have another NSC official, Morrison, who was on that July 25th phone call. And then we have Kurt Volker, who is involved with Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU, and who will actually have to kind of reconcile some shifting testimony that he's had. He's going to tell House investigators that he actually wasn't involved in some of those key conversations. So I think that when we step back and look at what's happening today, the morning session is going to be the most important part of this, of today's impeachment hearing.
We have about 30 seconds left. We have testimony today, tomorrow, and Thursday. Who's on deck for tomorrow's testimony?
Well, if you thought that today was a huge day of marathon testimony, tomorrow is going to possibly be even bigger because we're going to hear from Gordon Sondland, like I said, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, who is really one of those people who is directly involved, allegedly, with President Trump's attempt to elicit that personal political favor. It's going to be crucial that Democrats get a TV moment out of him where he talks about exactly what happened with Ukrainian President Zelensky.
Catherine Gibson reports for VOA from Capitol Hill. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
Waves of student protests in Hong Kong attempted daring escapes and past police lines, while fewer than 200 others remain barricaded inside a university that has been surrounded by riot police since Sunday. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Hong Kong. The protesters are getting increasingly desperate.
Some students have attempted dramatic escapes, sliding down ropes to waiting motorcycles, which tried to zoom past police lines and clouds of tear gas to freedom. Others have chosen to stay at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. VOA Cantonese service reporter Iris Tong was inside the campus and described scenes of exhaustion and desperation.
I can feel their hopeless. Yeah, so it is quite sad to see the situation like that, yeah. But I saw two boys, yeah. They're all teenagers, two people. I saw one boy. He just said he wanted to kill himself, but I didn't see him really cut and hurt, and I didn't see any blood from his neck.
Police have ordered the protesters to drop their homemade weapons and leave campus through a single exit, where they likely would face riot-related charges. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam defended police actions and sharply criticized the protesters.
They have to stop violence, give up their weapons, and come out peacefully and take the instructions from the police.
Police have fired tear gas and rubber bullets at those attempting to flee. At night, waves of protesters have tried unsuccessfully to breach police lines and reach the campus with supplies. The clashes are some of the worst violence since anti-government protests began in Hong Kong 5 months ago. Neither Beijing nor Hong Kong authorities show signs of giving in. Some pro-democracy activists were encouraged earlier this week when Hong Kong's High Court ruled that the government's recent ban on face masks was unconstitutional. The face mask ban, which went into effect last month, punished offenders with up to a year in jail. But China's top legislature on Tuesday slammed the court ruling, insisting Hong Kong courts have no authority to rule on the legality of legislation. Beijing's statement fundamentally threatens the rule of law in Hong Kong, says lawyer and author Anthony Dapperin.
But if they do go ahead with this and formally interpret the basic law that prevents the Hong Kong courts from reviewing the constitutionality of legislation, that is a fundamental change to the Hong Kong legal system. It pulls away one of the struts that props up the Hong Kong rule of law.
Many Hong Kongers are outraged by the steady erosion of the one country, two systems policy that Beijing has used to govern Hong Kong since Britain handed it over to China in 1997. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Hong Kong.
Chief U.S. negotiator James DeHart says Washington and Seoul remain far apart on the issue of how much South Korea should pay for the costs of maintaining an American military presence on its own soil.
We cut short our participation in the talks today in order to give the Korean side some time to reconsider And I hope to put forward new proposals.
DeHart said the U.S. meeting with its South Korean counterparts lasted less than 2 hours because Seoul's proposals were not responsive to their request for fair and equitable burden sharing, but left the door open for future dialogue.
We look forward to resuming our negotiations when the Korean side is ready to work on the basis of partnership and on the basis of mutual trust.
The turbulent negotiations come at a delicate time for the allies, which face a growing North Korean threat and have squabbled over Seoul's declaration to terminate a 2016 military intelligence sharing pact with Japan amid a bilateral dispute. Jung-un Bo, a South Korean negotiator, told reporters that the countries have scheduled their next round of talks, but didn't specify when. Jung refused to say how much the Americans were asking Seoul to pay. But he said Washington has demanded Seoul cover a broader range of costs than it has in the past, including the wages of South Korean employees on U.S. bases and costs for facility construction and logistics support. In addition, South Korea and China announced a defense exchange agreement that includes initiatives to facilitate bilateral military exchanges and cooperation. Defense Minister Jong Kyung-do expects to visit Beijing during the year 2020. North Korea also announced it will not consider a recent U.S. decision to postpone a joint military exercise with South Korea as a major concession that can bring it back to nuclear talks. A senior North Korean official, Kim Jong-chol, said the U.S. must completely scrap that military drill and abandon its hostility against his country if it wants to see the resumption of nuclear negotiations. And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Diets high in protein but low in carbohydrates are quite popular among people who want to lose weight and hold on to lean muscle mass. Cutting down on the amount of foods high in carbohydrates and replacing them with those rich in proteins and healthy fats is supposed to help the body switch its fuel source from sugars to stored fat. A new paper from researchers at the European Renal Association and the European Dialysis and Transplant Association suggests these diets may also harm your kidneys. The researchers point out that high-protein, low-carbohydrate diets are often recommended to people who suffer from diabetes or who are obese. Denis Fouquet, past chair of the European Renal Nutrition Working Group, says that while a high-protein diet may help these people lose weight, it also comes with a risk of severe loss of kidney function. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced on Monday the U.S. is changing its position on Israeli settlements in the West Bank, dismissing the State Department's 1978 legal opinion that civilian settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories are inconsistent with international law. The announcement is the latest in the Trump administration's moves to weaken Palestinian claims to statehood. VOA's Zlatissa Hoek has that story.
The international community largely considers the establishment of Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories as illegal and violating an article of the Fourth Geneva Convention that does not allow the occupying power to transfer its own population to the territory it occupies. Israel claims it has not violated the international law because Israeli citizens have not been transferred to the settlements. Pompeo said U.S. administrations have changed their stance over the decades and that the Trump administration is now breaking away from the Obama administration's approach.
After carefully studying all sides of the legal debate, this administration agrees with President Reagan. The establishment of Israeli civilian settlements in the West Bank is not, per se, inconsistent with international law.
Until now, official U.S. policy was based on a legal opinion issued by the State Department in 1978, which said that establishing settlements in the Palestinian territories went against international law. No U.S. president has ever reversed that policy, but all have avoided calling the settlements illegal, preferring to describe them as a major obstacle to peace in the Middle East. Pompeo said calling the establishing of civilian settlements inconsistent with international law has not advanced the cause of peace.
The hard truth is there will never be a judicial resolution to the conflict, and arguments about who is right and wrong as a matter of international law will not bring peace. This is a complex political problem that can only be solved by negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The United States remains deeply committed to helping facilitate peace, and I will do everything I can to help this cause.
Palestinian leaders have refused any U.S. mediation after U.S. President Donald Trump recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Palestinians want East Jerusalem as the capital of their future state. They see Trump's Middle East policies as biased in favor of Israel. U.S. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders tweeted that Israeli settlements in the occupied territory are illegal and said that the U.S. president is undermining diplomacy by pandering to his extremist base. The European Union issued a statement reiterating that all settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, are illegal under international law, and called on Israel to end all settlement activity in line with its obligations as an occupying power. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
The UN Human Rights Office reaffirmed its long-standing position that Israeli settlements in occupied Palestinian territory are in breach of international law, thereby rejecting the Trump administration's revised position. Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the U.S. decision undermined the legal basis for a settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and warned the moves would escalate tensions in the region. Israel's military also said its missile defense system shot down four rockets fired from Syria toward Israel early Tuesday. Israel captured the Golan from Syria in a 1967 war and later annexed it and settled it. Moves not accepted by most world powers. The Taliban said they freed on Tuesday an American and an Australian hostage held since 2016 in exchange for three top Taliban figures who were released by Kabul and flown out of Afghanistan on Monday. The hostages, American Kevin King and Australian Timothy Weeks, were released in southern Zabul province, ending more than 3 years in captivity. Sweden on Tuesday dropped its investigation into alleged rape by WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is currently in prison in Britain because too much time has elapsed since the accusation was made over 9 years ago. Assange, who is battling an extradition attempt by the U.S. so he can face spying charges related to his WikiLeaks work, has always denied the allegations made against him during a visit to Stockholm in August of 2010. Amnesty International, citing credible reports, says it believes at least 106 people have been killed during protests in Iran over government-set gasoline prices rising. Iran has since shut down the internet and deployed police and anti-riot forces to quell the unrest. Demonstrations are believed to be going on in the country. Thousands of protesters rallying against the Lebanese political elite blocked roads in central Beirut Tuesday, preventing lawmakers from reaching the parliament and forcing the postponement of a legislative session. The session had been scheduled, even though the country is still without a cabinet following the prime minister's resignations amid unprecedented demonstrations that have gripped Lebanon since mid-October. The protesters are questioning the constitutionality of the parliament session in the absence of a government. The country, which suffers from widespread corruption, has one of the highest debts in the world, standing at $86 billion, or 150 times its gross domestic product. The Ukrainian journalist Oleg Sentsov, who was jailed in Russia for reporting on the country's illegal annexation of Crimea and murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, were among those honored in the recent Magnitsky Awards ceremony in London. The awards pay tribute to those who risk their lives to stand up for human rights, and Henry Ridgewell reports.
Ukrainian journalist Oleg Sentsov was given the 2018 Human Rights Award at the ceremony in London Thursday, a year late, as he was only released from jail in September. Sentsov had been reporting on Moscow's forced annexation of Crimea in 2014 when he was arrested and convicted on false terrorism charges. Meghan McCain, daughter of the late U.S. Senator John McCain, presented the award.
He was tortured. He was sentenced to 20 years. He was sent to Siberia. He was sent to the Arctic. He suffered. He was imprisoned for a very, very long time. I know a little bit about men who are unjustly imprisoned. Their captors tried to break them, but they emerged stronger than ever before. That's Oleg Sentsov.
Speaking to VOA, Sentsov called for the release of the hundreds of other Ukrainians. Now there are about 100 of our people imprisoned in Russia, Sentsov said. Most of them are Crimean Tatars. Also, there are more than 200 imprisoned by separatists in Donbass, in the territory controlled by Russia. All the prisoners must be freed because they were jailed illegally and they are hostages of the Kremlin. China's oppression of Uyghur Muslims is intensifying, with over 1 million believed detained in camps in Xinjiang province. Gulchehra Hoxha of VOA's sister station Radio Free Asia received the Magnitsky Human Rights Award for 2019 for exposing the oppression.
The world's silence has only encouraged China to expand its concentration camps to hold millions of people. And those outside the camps suffer under the world's worst Orwellian mass surveillance police state.
The Magnitsky Awards are named after lawyer Sergei Magnitsky, who was beaten to death 10 years ago by Russian prison guards after exposing a $230 million state tax fraud. His death was echoed by that of Saudi Arabian journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed and dismembered by Saudi officials at the country's consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Khashoggi's fiancée accepted his posthumous award for Courage Under Fire.
I feel that Sergei Magnitsky and Jamal's spirits and souls are with us right now, and they are smiling with us. And as much as they have taken Jamal from on this world, we will continue to fight and keep his values alive.
To keep up that fight, Bill Browder, Sergei Magnitsky's former client, has campaigned for so-called Magnitsky legislation to be passed around the world, enabling the sanctioning of human rights violators. By highlighting the sacrifices of those who stand against such abuses, it's hoped the Magnitsky Awards will help to end the culture of impunity. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In Japan, authorities have ruled that an engineer at Toyota killed himself to escape constant ridicule from his boss. Toyota Motor Corp. acknowledged the case after reports of the ruling emerged Tuesday. The company said it hopes to prevent more such cases and express condolences over the death. VOA's Jeff Custer has more.
The case came amid growing awareness of what the Japanese call power harassment. A regional labor bureau ruled in September that the 2017 suicide entitled the victim's family to compensation under a law regarding job-related deaths. Such rulings in Japan are sometimes not disclosed for weeks. Yoshihide Takino, the attorney for the victim and his family, said Toyota was responsible for mismanagement, for allowing the harassment to continue. Takino said the 28-year-old worker was repeatedly called an idiot by his boss and told he should die. The descendant's name was withheld due to privacy concerns. He joined Toyota in 2015. After a year of training, he was sent to the company's headquarters in Toyota City in central Japan. The investigation showed the young engineer's boss bullied him with constant insults, ordered him not to take days off, and ridiculed his educational background, since his undergraduate degree was not from an elite university. The engineer told those around him that he could not endure the harassment and would rather die to escape the suffering. The case highlights an endemic problem in Japan, where a workaholic corporate culture and zealous loyalty to an employer often are taken for granted. Workers often forego vacations and put in many hours of overtime without pay. The Ministry of Health, Labor and Welfare says last year, 199 suicides were ruled job-related. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha, engineer Jonah Cummings, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.